Welcome, Mind Tribers, and everybody on a self-development journey to improve their mind, body, spirit, and business lives. Now, today we've got a very special guest. It's entrepreneur, investor, and shark on Channel 10 Shark Tank, Steve Baxter. Now, Steve is one of Australia's most successful tech entrepreneurs and an active investor and mentor for startups in Australia and globally. Steve founded River City Labs, a well-known co-working hub in 2012, and he's been championing startups and entrepreneurs ever since. And he's recently launched, which we'll talk a bit about today, 1013, and we'll talk a little bit about his other endeavors in investment, transition level investments. So without further ado, Steve, how are you going today?
Good, Ben. How's yourself, mate?
Excellent, mate. Excellent. Well, thanks for joining me today on Mindtribe. I really just want to learn a little bit about what's going on with the state of the startup environment, entrepreneurship and stuff like that. What have you been up to lately? Tell me some of the most exciting things, I guess, that's happened.
Oh, well, recently. Yeah, right. So, lots, I suppose. I mean, I have a young family, so that keeps me exceptionally busy and introduces enough sort of, you know, pleasant conflict into my life with professional and family sort of relationship. You've had a young family as well.
I know what it's like, and you've got three,
under eight,
running around. Yeah. And yeah, that's quite hectic. So how do you manage all that?
Poorly. I often say that our road to becoming a family wasn't something I wish on my worst enemy. But I don't know what I would have done if I had kids while I was running businesses, to be honest. So I'm glad I wasn't put into that. In some, you know, one aspect of that is I'm glad I wasn't forced to make that decision. So I do have a business now. We have an investing business, and I have various other investments and things I manage. So I've learned a few things that I really pull myself into things. I tend to pull myself into the weeds in businesses.
I do the same.
That's the strategy, yeah. Keeps you very busy, which is good. How do I manage that? You know, wake up early, take the dog for a walk, spend some time at breakfast with the girls. It's all girls in the house. It's just me and the dog, the only boys in the house, basically. Come home. It's not always easy to get home before they go to bed because it's business. There's a lot of social engagements, which are typically after work, that you get to. I do a lot less of those. I used to do two or three a week. No, I try and keep it to less than one a fortnight. So how do I do it? You know, it's, well, we do, you know, thanks to the pandemic, we only do Mondays and Wednesdays in the office as a full team.
Yeah, great.
So, manage to spend a little bit of time back at home, although I'll probably go in at least 3 days a week because I have a meeting in the city. So I work from the city. And where we are here, we live in the same suburb. Yeah. We're about 45 to an hour and 10, depending on traffic from the city.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got to really want to do that drive.
do you find the balance, I guess, with the hybrid sort of setup with employees? Obviously, everyone said initially it was great and people were enjoying it. And then are you guys finding a balance now? Are you finding people are?
I think we've got the balance. So when we first started, I'm very much a traditional boss. I think people should turn up to work. My first job was a soldier for 9 years. I didn't turn up to work on time exactly. I was in jail. And I was, you know, you were roughly dragged to jail in handcuffs. You didn't ever do that twice.
And just for the listeners, obviously your background is really interesting, right? So obviously you're from the country originally.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah. I was born in Cloncurry. I left there when I was 10 months old. I don't recall very much, but Dad was in the railway and moved around a little bit. The majority of my family and extended family were born in Rockhampton. I think I was only one of two or three out of, you know, 50 odd, aunties, uncles and cousins that weren't born in Rockhampton. And Uncle Reggie was born in Bar Cauldron of all places, but you know, I was born in Cloncurry. Spent a lot of time in Emerald in central Queensland, fantastic out there, you know, coal, cattle, you know, something like 160 years world thermal coal supply in the Bowen Basin. I think it's a tremendous resource. A lot of people hate me for that opinion, but that's just life. China's going to burn it. We might as well. So great childhood out there. You know, left there when I was in grade six. I was probably 10 or 11, I suppose. Never used to have prep in Queensland, so, you know, I was a bit younger back then. And back to Rockhampton, 15 years old, I joined the Army as a regular soldier back when the Army could recruit 15-year-olds. Signed up for a 9-year contract when I was 15 years old.
9 years, wow. Yeah. And what did you learn? Is there anything that's kind of transpired now into business in terms of the disciplines? And is there, you know, polishing your boots? I don't know. Is there anything?
Yeah, but that's an important thing. I mean, especially, I think the businesses I've always been in, business I'm in now especially, which is investment, where things move exceptionally slow. We should declare you're a customer of our business too, right, Ben, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But so And we present deals to people like yourself who are our customers and investors. I like to use the word customer in our business because I think it makes our staff focus on who the hell they're dealing with. They're not investors. They're not soft and squishy. They're customers who expect value.
Yeah.
I think that's an important thing. So, and, you know, we can spend 12 months failing to get a deal, or, you know, we can spend 6 months, you know, in the process of getting a deal and we have to execute it in a week. So it's a lot of boring mixed in with a lot of exciting. So, you know, sometimes when you're fighting the spreadsheets and fighting the DD, and you want to achieve something simple, wake up and polish your boots. You feel better for it. Yeah. They look good. You wouldn't know this today. I've been out in the dust at the moment. My boots are terrible. But, yeah.
Did you find is there a work ethic or routine? We've recently brought someone into the business who's an ex-SAS guy, actually, and was at Telstra for a while. And, I think there's a lot of routines he's still kept. Is it getting up early? What's your routine look like?
I've got a bit of a vampire gene. As soon as a photon of sunlight comes through the window, I burst into flames and wake up. I've never been able to sleep, and I so wish I could. I mean, that's just me forever.
Yep.
That's fine. I just work with it. So, which, if you know Queensland summers where the sun gets up at 4:30 in the morning, it's just diabolical, right?
Yeah.
So, but in general, look, the army, I think, you know, I get asked this a lot, and what it taught me is it definitely teaches work. I think it teaches punctuality. And I don't know, I believe it softened quite a bit, but it was quite a martial teaching and learning process. If you didn't do what you were told, you got fucking beat up. So that wasn't the official line, but that's damn sure what happened. But hey, it's a martial job. If you can't survive a clip around the ears, you're probably not very good in a bayonet charge, right? So,
Do you find that's a disadvantage though? Sometimes, like with obviously the younger generation's quite nurtured and quite haven't, and this may be, it's probably just my opinion, but, yeah, do you define as sort of your sort of expectations? Is there any challenge there?
Yeah, there is a big expectation. So where I was going to with the story, I suppose, in a roundabout way, is I'm a very traditional boss. So I had two businesses before this one, a telecoms business out of South Australia and a telecoms business out of Brisbane. And I suppose we didn't have technology back in the day, so you could work from home anyway, or you could reliably or productively work from home. It's gotten a lot better in the last 5 years, probably the last 10 years, last 5 years especially. So, you know, we always had people in the office and there was an expectation you'd turn up to work. Like in the army, we worked hard, we partied hard. If you went out and had maybe a few too many brews the night before, no one really cared. But if you turned up to work hungover or drunk and couldn't do your job, then you're in jail.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's an expectation that you can do it. You're just there to do your job, don't let people down. So I took a little bit of that in. The younger generation are always different, wrong, and lazier and whatever. They're all lovely, don't get me wrong, but as old people, we tend to have less patience for younger people, I suppose, as a loose description. So it is hard, but there again, when you employ people, you're in a marketplace for talent.
Mm.
And if everyone out there if people are pandering to that talent, then you've got to make the choice to do that or not. At the end of the day, the people you get are still good. They still want to come on. They can still buy into the vision your company's got. But you have to understand, I suppose, what pushes their buttons. I'm not big on the woke stuff. I don't like any of that sort of thing. I wish you keep politics the hell out of work, to be quite honest.
Yeah. Yep.
So we don't really put up with much of that. We do get a lot of pressure in our business to follow, modern, cuddly guidelines on things. You know, that we, you know, one of the functions last year we put up on a slide. I didn't know it was there until I saw it that, you know, X many of our investments in the previous 12 months had female founders or I learned what POC was, which is people of color. So, I don't care about that sort of stuff. If anything, I'm quite greedy in my outlook. You can be a three-headed alien. And if you can run a business that's going to do well and we can invest in and do well with you along beside you, we'll do that. I don't care your sex, your gender, your color, anything. We've got businesses in Africa, Asia. We've got run by women. It's actually the last thing I look at. Believe it or not, I look at merit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And after that, and typically it's pretty evenly distributed, to be quite blunt. Mm-hmm.
What are your sort of thoughts now, I guess, on the landscape? And one thing that really sort of I picked up on a 10-13 event that was out recently was and listening to some of the founders that have gone to Silicon Valley and traveled, just how important talent is. And I guess obviously the shifting landscapes, obviously with COVID going on and things like that. I'm not saying is it more important than ever, but
It's always been important. I think it is only more important. It's always been the most important. It's even more the most important. And that's a roundabout. Yeah, grammatically, obviously, it's nonsense. But I suppose what's happened in the last the last time, probably the last 10 years at least, is the computing platform has become really cheap, right? As a result, they're exceptionally powerful. They're very, very value dense. As a result, the programs have become very lazy. I shouldn't say that. There's been less emphasis on actually extracting every last piece of CPU resource out of that computer platform. And as such, the languages are and the development frameworks are actually quite abstracted out.
Yep.
So, and as a result, it's therefore you don't need to know as much low down computer core code, and you can use the frameworks of Rubies and other bits and pieces and everything that's out there. So as a result, you've got you can develop stuff really fast. So instead of having to go from the ground up every time, you've got all this infrastructure and framework built on that you can actually just create your applications from. And as a result, these people are now in demand. We've got some tailwinds of COVID, for example. We've had tailwinds in this industry now for probably about a dozen years at least, I would think, but COVID's really kicked that off. And as a result, these people are in demand. 5 years ago, I would say they were paid less than the average wage. Maybe 7 years ago, they were paid less than the average wage, 2010, 12, 13, let's say. And they're now paid way more than the average wage, which is good. They're probably more productive than the average worker. In a purely economic sense, that's nothing meant to be insulting for anybody. They're in demand. It's a marketplace. If they're in demand and people want their skills, they can put their price up. So,
and can the economy keep up with that? Like, I guess, because obviously the wages seem to be going up right now, like in terms of trying to get developers in particular in the tech environment, which forces the prices up, I guess, of platforms. Is that something that's sustainable, or do you think it's going to plateau out?
I don't think it's changed. It's gone, it's been on a it's been rising forever. So I was in Silicon Valley during the GFC. And it's probably the only part of America that wasn't suffering the GFC. I mean, the restaurants were only 90% full, not 100% full. I mean, that's when you're doing the heart in Silicon Valley, right? So, there's always been a large demand there. It's a very constantly changing environment. So you have to evolve your skills in that space. You can't just sit there and just, if all you know is X, Y, Z, and next year it's going to be ABC. And you've got to be able to evolve into that landscape frameworks, those sectors, whatever it might be. So it's very fast. It's very rapidly changing. Probably for 2 years, you've got to turn your skill set over. But that being said, in the computing space, a structured computer and a structured object-oriented programming language, honestly, programmers, but if you can do one, you can do them all.
Yeah.
Some people are better at some, but really, if you can do one, those skills are really transportable. It's just structured programming, or typically object-oriented, and some of the web frameworks now as well. So good skill base. I don't think it's going to go down, no. There's so much of this no-code, low-code stuff that's coming out. You're paying more for low-code engineers than you are for no-code for code engineers. It's really weird, isn't it? So people who know less about computing are actually sort of being able to attract more money. You need less of them, I suppose. That's probably the upside.
Are they dumbing that down for me? Is that people that are sort of using, say, Canva instead of Pro Tools, or Webflow, for example? It's less
similar. So in one project I'm doing right now, I suppose it'll be Salesforce administering and configuring the Salesforce environment, not so much developing, as opposed to maybe developing in the Salesforce environment or developing in any environment where you actually have a structured language. It might be compiled or something similar, or interpreted at the very least anyway. But this is more, it's called low code or no code. So it's configuration of someone else's systems for your business end.
And that should open up the talent pool, right? In a way, because...
Well, I'd say the bifurcation I've seen there, which is really interesting, is that when we went out looking for a Salesforce admin, and all the respondents actually thought that the employment agent was having a crack at me. All the resumes I got were female. I've employed lots of geeks before, and they're mostly all blokes, if you know what I mean. So it's like we've employed some great females in those roles over the years, but the majority is usually men. And this is all females. And I remember the guy said, "Mate, are you trying to pull the Mickey out of me? What's going on, Ryan?" And he goes, "No. If you're an admin, that's it. This is it. 90% of that space is female." And he did end up sending through one extra token male resume. That kid was good, actually. Give him 3 years, he would have been really good in the role. But the lady we employ is and has ended up being fantastic.
Great to see.
But he said, you go on that dev, you go on that computer, right, that turns around. You're 90% bloke-skinned. And which is, I found that to be really weird. I've never seen that in an area of computing before. So it was interesting.
You've spent a lot of time. You actually worked over at Google in Silicon Valley and, you've had a lot of exposure, ran a lot of trips for startups, within Australia, going to Silicon Valley. What is it that they do there that we're catching up with here? Or is What have you seen and what's been your experiences, I guess, from being
exposed? I don't know if catching up. I think we're doing the things we should have always done a little better. So you can't beat the American free enterprise engine. I think you've seen the lunacy of the regulations overimposed during COVID to understand at a health response level. That's what's what typically happens at the business level in Australia. We're overregulated. And there's no room to experiment in Australia. So in the US, you have 50 places to experiment. Every state has their own business rules, essentially, right? And so they can attract they can attract certain types of businesses through tax incentives or less regulation or whatever it might be, you know. A lot of people in Australia see that as chaotic. I agree. It's not a bug. It's a feature. The feature is, you know, if you don't like, you know, developing, if you don't like paying $250,000 for a developer in San Francisco, which is what you're paying now, US, for God's sakes.
Yeah, wow.
Then go to Texas and pay $120,000. Right. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, there's pros and cons against that.
I've heard Texas is it's a new hub down there. And
mate, Salt Lake City, mate. You know, Florida. Yeah, there's a bunch of places that compete and draw that talent away. So, my point there, I suppose, is that, you know, it's hard in Australia because we just seem to be so proud to regulate, and you know, I would get pulled into so many political panels and think tanks and, you know, round tables about how they should do this X, Y, and Z regulation lesson. I said, you should put this thing down, and you haven't got an eraser there, have you?
It's on the back of that. Yeah.
Oh, it's in the back of that. So there you go. Yeah. You should put the pencil down, pick up the rubber, and just start rubbing stuff out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because for as much as you might, the previous US administration under Donald Trump, and people try to understand pre-COVID why their economy was going so well. And everyone said it was because of, you know, latent Obama reforms, which is rubbish because there's no reforms and there was only regulation. You reform when you actually take regulation out. Trump removed regulations from the business environment, so they're the lowest since 1974.
Yeah.
And then you actually saw on the graph, you actually saw a corresponding rise in GW School of Regulatory Studies. Great graphs, they published them. You can actually see the concurrent rise in the economy and employment with these regulations going off. You couldn't get a better correlation. That to me was very informative. Love or hate him for his politics, doesn't matter. You've got a really good example of what his administration did with respect to business regulation. So over there they are very keen to experiment. They're okay with failure. I don't like the failure word because I think it's misunderstood, especially in the Australian context and in the startup context. But I suppose you spend less time in the penalty box, and that's a very American term. Penalty box is obviously an ice hockey term in the US, but you spend less time in the penalty box in the US if you've had a business failure than you do in Australia. Yeah. If business failure here, you've got this stupid old city beat writing about you, calling you bankrupt forever and everything, and you'd never escape it, right? You know, which is, and I get it, people have lost money. And so I'm not saying that you should be laissez-faire running a business and run it to the ground. You know, if it doesn't work, you should tie it up, pay your creditors.
But that's one of the things of a startup, right? I think one of the mentalities I had early on was the worst case is I'll just go get a job or something. You know, like it's you should be allowed to feel safe in creating a new business.
Yeah, I think so. And it comes down to, you know, like I said, if it doesn't go well, then you tie it up. You sit there, you tie it up, and you draw a line under it. And, you know, everyone took a risk by doing either investing in you or doing business with you. They took a risk. And everyone has to understand that risk and, you know, do what you can to tie it up, pay your creditors out, pay your staff out. But, you know, if that's, let's say you've taken 3 years to almost get there, but it falls over, that's one hell of an MBA. You know what I mean? Do you reckon you're going to make the same mistakes twice? Nah. You know, why don't we get that risk and recycle it back into the economy faster, if you know what I mean? That's very much, I think, what the US does well with their Chapter 11. I had nothing good to say about Malcolm Turnbull and his time as Prime Minister, and especially with respect to his NISA, National Innovation and Science Agenda, $2-something billion, of which 1.9 went to universities and we've never seen again, right? So I think that method of innovation is gone. But one thing that came out of that was the ASIC and the Corporations Act reforms. So we introduced the Director Safe Harbors, which is a really, really vital piece of legislation. It takes us more towards Chapter 11 for businesses that are on the edge. And then ipso facto, there's a whole bunch of reforms around insolvency, essentially.
Okay.
And it allows businesses to go, we're about to go broke. What do we do? And previously, it was, we've got no choice but to call an administrator. And the administrator goes, great, you've got $500,000 left. Awesome. I can pay myself $100,000 for 5 months. I can run that down and everyone gets nothing. That might be being unfair to turnaround managers or insolvency practitioners. No, it's not actually. That's what they do, to be honest. So, under these reforms under Safe Harbor, you could say, look, we're almost going to go broke. Look, you know, if If we bring in one of these insolvency, if we bring in a professional to assist us and we do certain other actions, we make sure staff are paid, we make sure the ATO is up to date and a few other bits up to date with information, not with money, up to date with data, then we can continue trading potentially whilst insolvent. If we have a plan to get to an outcome, that's better than if we did go insolvent.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah. I think it's a really good practical mix. So not going to talk about that, but you know, that if you want to run a business that's innovative and you want to try really brave game of things, then lots of things are going to hit the wall and go splat instead of breakthrough, right?
Yeah. Just sort of change your gears a bit, but just talking about founders and what it takes, because it is, we talked about obviously the risk and then being safe if you fail in a business. But you just want to talk to the passion and what, you know, what is the something that you're looking for besides all the DD and all this sort of stuff when it comes to a startup, particularly around a founder is, you know, for me, I think obviously passion is a big thing, and I don't know how you sort of put a word into that, but passion's obviously.
Yeah. We're an investor. We look for reasons to say no. So we get a whole bunch of things that will just kill the deal. Right. And that is great. We can, you know, because we get.
Are you willing to share some of those?
Yeah, cool. We've gone from 50 to 60 deals a month now to, we did 97 last month.
Wow.
Excuse me. We looked at 97 deals last month. We get lots of things we don't invest in, we just throw away instantly. That's not them. That's ones we go, oh, okay, this is something good to invest in. Let's actually look at this harder. So we sift a lot to do our 1 to 2 deals a month. Well, people are probably averaging 1.5 deals a month. So,
that's incredible.
So things like, if the founder lies to you, if there's a lie, I mean, you can sex things up and you talk to them, but if there's a lie, that's just a forward indicator for future problems and you're done. You cut them. You never go back to them. So, that's a really big one. So I've got personal red lines I want to invest in. Things like, I don't want to ban them, but I don't support them. Things like online gambling, gaming, mobile gaming, things like that. So, so they're pretty easy to cut. When it comes to teams, on many levels, so I'm trying to think top down. You know, passion's one thing, and that's hard to identify at times as well because people could fake passion at the same time, right?
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
So, but then you look at how have they structured their teams? So a lot of times they will have built nothing as an idea, and we've backed ideas. We call them post idea. People sort of say, is that Series A, Series B, seed phase? We said, well, it's a sort of post idea, sort of pre-revenue. But the team is, they've put together a team. They've understood there's a problem. They understand that there's a solution. They've put an amazing team together and we'll back them to back that. We'll back them to attack that problem. So when we look at the team, it's like, can you do this in-house? If you can't do this in-house, why the hell are we backing you?
Yeah.
You're just going to take our money and give it to the guys over there who can actually do it. So why should we talk to those guys over there? So ability to execute is really, really strong.
I remember doing some mentorship with River City Labs that you founded, right? And you had a T-shirt, which was execution is everything.
Execution is everything. Well, it is. And it's weird because we never used to – we go on in phases, I suppose. We prefer backing things with that have traction. And people sort of say, you know, what's the best traction is profit. If you got profit, you don't need me. You know what I mean? So you've done well, and congratulations. Keep the business yourself. Don't go to an investor.
Can you explain to the audience why some businesses that are just losing money at a rapid rate of knots are getting huge valuations in terms of just the concept around, particularly platform businesses, right? Or I guess is it the ability to scale? Tesla was a good one, where they've got huge revenue. Not making money, but they're,
I've still lots on Tesla because Tesla has none of those. It has a founder who I think tracks money, and that's great. But I don't think it has the typical. It doesn't have the typical properties of something that attracts wild valuations. So, the reason you attract wild valuations for many reasons. For a start, it's worth what someone's willing to pay for it. If you've got whatever business and you're out there to raise money, and you can raise $10 million and $100 million valuation, and you've got zero revenue, and there's 20 people willing to pay it. That's what you're worth,
yep.
Right? So it doesn't fit traditional business metrics. But at the end of the day, any accountant will tell you is your business is worth what someone's willing to pay for it.
And is that the belief thing, right? There's a book I read recently called Sapiens, and it was basically talking about how once we got to a certain, we couldn't travel past 50 people, but then we created, you know, belief in religion or whatever it might have been. But essentially, I guess the example here is in business is it's a bit of paper, right? At the end of the day, it's an idea, it's a concept, but getting that belief to, you know, it's more of a leadership concept, I guess.
excuse me. So look, Don't know about that. I have not really thought about in those terms. We're looking about why some businesses are valued at stupid levels. Size of the market, size of the problem. So, you know, Canva, for example, which I believe at last count was doing like $100 million or $1 billion in run rate revenue, right? It's
incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're worth $30 billion now and rapidly taking down Adobe, who's worth, I think Adobe's worth about $190 billion.
Wow.
So, you know, people are sort of seeing them as an Adobe competitor, for example. So they're investing out 30 on the hope they'll be 150. So everyone invests for the hope of making a profit, right? So they can see something in the market that actually, and there's a very charismatic leadership team there, and they've got the runs on the board with growth. The other reason that people invest in you tend to hear these multiples in startups, on very low numbers as opposed to no numbers is typically growth. So, you know, if you're turning over $1 million a year, but if, you know, in 6 months time, you're turning over two, and then in 6 months after that, you're turning over four, then if you invest at a silly valuation now, in 12 months time, it's only one quarter of a silly valuation, right?
Yeah, right.
So, it's only a valuation of, yeah, I got the right way around, didn't I? So, so growth, I'm investing in growth, great teams, growth, amazing market potential, market penetration. In that space there. So, and then, you know, that if, and at the end of the day, if you think that there's a business out there that's going to attack a problem in that space, and in our business, we might get access, there might be a $5 million Series A going off, and we potentially have access to $1 million of that for our syndicate. And if the other people buying the other $4 million have set the valuation at $50 million and there's competition for that million, we've just got to pay it.
Yeah.
If we believe that team is going to take, if we believe that team is going to take that 50 mil bail and turn it into 100 in like 12 months or, you know, 24 months time, that's a good deal, right? So, still a lot of risk in there. Don't get me wrong. So we take venture scale bets too. That we want, you know, we're aiming for something at some point in time to come off, you know, 200,000-300,000x for us.
Yeah. Wow.
That's
insane.
We'll have one. We're about to do one, and it'll. When's this going to get to air?
Oh, probably a week or so.
All right. So 6 days ago.
Yeah.
Or tomorrow in today's terms.
Yep.
Should be announced our latest exit, which will be for me personally after about 17 was the first one. So it was at 4 years, 16 times.
That's incredible.
So, and so that, you know, and the investors we brought into our syndicate who came in a bit later, they've done exceptionally well over a very, very much shorter period of time. So, my best one in recent times is the last 10 years has been 24x.
Yeah. And that's an incredible story. We're actually looking at it for our businesses at the moment. But just because it really has solved the problem, right? Which is, how do you maintain your own LMS and your own content?
Well, they're content LMS. I mean, they work with LMSs as well. They've got their own LMS platform there. They've got the content marketplace, which is huge. So they're really trying to be that Netflix for do you want to get that or not? You're right.
No, that's fine.
No. They're trying to be that marketplace for corporate training, you know. So, which is massive. Corporate training and retraining is huge.
Mm.
So it's a big problem. It's a massive space. They've been backed with dizzying amounts of capital to go and attack that, because ultimately everyone looked at the team and went, oh my God, Andrew, Chris, and Vu. So I don't get four of them. Mm. And you talk to them for like 10 minutes. You're like, I just, when I first spoke to them, they didn't want money. I'm like, they were about to go off to the Y Combinator in the US.
Mm.
Had no requirement for capital at that point in time. And I'm like, oh, just cool, let's stay friends. So, you know, yeah, well. When they didn't want the money, I was just, yeah, cool, here it is. So I think I wrote 3 checks for them in the end.
So that, I mean, that's a wise decision, because, I mean, you've seen that pay off. And obviously, I guess the goal there is to have the wins offset the losses, right? I mean, you're going to make a few of them and minimize that through DD and that sort of thing. So sort of circling back to that, is there anything else that you sort of would, you know, you've mentioned obviously ethics and integrity and, you know, lying, obviously that's a huge one.
Mm.
Is there anything else that are you looking for things that are platform focused more so?
We don't like hardware.
Yep.
So, not many investors do. Not many investors, you know, less investors like hardware than software, if I was to characterize that.
And reason? What's the reason for that?
Hardware's well named. It's hard. You've got a logistical tail behind you. You know, software doesn't have a shelf life. You know what I mean? It doesn't need to be shipped. There's a whole bunch of, you know, there's a business, I can't name the business, unfortunately. I met the chap in London, pre-COVID, obviously, at some dodgy pub where some Australian trade show thing was going on. And then I randomly ran into him in Perth on a separate trip. But his business is massive. He's like turning over. And this is years ago. He was turning over 23 mil when he was keeping 17.
Wow.
Software. Cool. Now, if you were shipping widgets around hardware and you had to solder things into boxes and no, you'd be lucky. And if in that sort of business on 23, if you'd kept three or four, you would have been described as a business genius. So there's a difference between hardware and software. At some point when you reach that inflection point, you go from, literally your margins all kick in, everything's paid for. So software gross margin is, if you've got a self-running sort of viral flywheel, then you've probably got 99% margins. If you've got some sort of sales force, it's probably 78, 80% margin.
You know, it's incredible yield, right? And I think that's what, I forget the exact stats, but when Facebook, their revenue per employee or something like that, it was insane.
It's insane, isn't it?
Yeah. It's like, you know, I just want to talk to you about, just the most common things that you see on the flip side of that you'd be looking for in a founder. I mean, we talked to sort of things that flags that you'd say no to. Is there something there that you go that's ticking a few boxes? I mean, passion was one of them you mentioned.
The absence of a no.
Yeah, right. So you're really looking at it from the lens of.
I used to say if I couldn't have a beer, barbecue, or fish with someone, I would invest in them. And I think it more goes down to the ethics question. That was probably a bit simplistic for me to say that. But the ethics question is pretty huge. Like, if you can't trust someone. Like, I know a lot of investors who take board seats in their investments to watch their money. I mean, if you've got to watch your fucking money, you shouldn't be investing in that company. Right? Yeah. Seriously, right? You're not going to trust them? Dude, you do want to walk away, right?
Yeah.
So, if we have to wash our money, then we won't. You know, we think we go on boards if we think we can add value at a board level. And I think that should be the hallmark. One of the key defining properties of a board member is they add value to that company at the board level. And if we can't do that, then we're just occupying a seat for someone else who could do a better job, right?
Yeah.
Things in founders and stuff. Like, look, you know, mix of tech skills and team. You know, integrity. You know, having a real eye to the problem, literally understand that they understand the space, they've seen the problem, that they know there's a market there, they know how to exploit it. For some reason, we think they're some of the best people in the world to attack that problem. And it's usually when you sit down and you have a deep, they display a deep understanding of the market. We invest in very few academics. We just did our first one recently.
Yeah.
Academic Leg Tummy. Were you in that one?
I was, yeah. That was a really interesting,
But typically academics are people who typically just don't all get upset at me. More often than not, don't know anything about the real world. Theory's great, but theory falls over in a heartbeat as soon as you talk to a customer, right? So this business does appear to be doing quite well, though. So, you know, we don't invest in the one thing we won't do is if there's any university IP, if there's any like official title university, we drop like a hot spot.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah.
And that's interesting because a lot of incubators within universities try to get the IP and leverage it.
And they lock it in the cupboard for 10 years and never use it, and all that money the taxpayer sends waste. But that's what we do in Australia. We invent shiny things in university. And it's a weird thing. If necessity is the mother of invention, our innovation policy in Australia is to say, no, invention, we're going to invent it and then we're going to find a need for it. Literally, that's what we do.
Yeah.
And we're good at it. And we pissed that much money away doing that. And we've created this really false impression of where people like, Data 61, CSIRO, Main Sequence Ventures, they're doing a lot to turn that around. You've got Bill Barty and his team there doing a great job, trying to drag this intellectual property out of places like CSIRO and get it into the light of day and actually drag these academics into trying to be entrepreneurs. You know, what we should be doing at a public policy level is making it easy to get into business. Mm. People sort of say, what should we do to start one business? Make it easy to start a business.
Yeah.
Shouldn't we? Let's invent some invention over here that some people somewhere in the world may want sometime next 20 years. Like, well, we should do that. Don't get me wrong, but we shouldn't actually look at that as a driver for commerce.
Yeah.
Right? So it should be, let's get a whole bunch of really smart people. Let's actually, how do you encourage people to start a business? Lots of ways. A, make it easy. B, make it less punitive in taxation sense when you do it. And actually one of the things that did come out of Malcolm Turnbull and this was something called ESIC, Early Stage Innovation Company. It's a tax-free structure type thing for investors in the early stage. Get your own advice. But, you know, so that wasn't bad either. So, but, you know, if we want more people taking more risks, then make it easy to start a company, make it very beneficial to start a company.
And with the, I guess, the lens of the current adversity in the with COVID, say, right? Now, there's a lot of businesses that are getting disrupted and evolving and changing, which is great. And it's sort of accelerating a lot of digital transformation, which is fantastic. Do you think you're going to see a lot of, or probably are seeing a lot of people capitalizing on that trend, and whether it's...
Yeah, there is, and we're seeing it. Look, I feel I'm very conflicted over it. I think that the level of value destruction that's occurred with businesses that did nothing wrong other than on this planet when a pandemic landed. And I think there's a lot of blame to lay in the pandemic on you know, in that Wuhan lab, to be honest. It's just dreadful what's occurred there. So, you know, people's livelihoods have been torn apart for none of the, and because they were in, what we're talking about, non-essential occupations or something stupid. Like we're actually categorizing people if they're good or bad, the way they're employed, non-essential. Now, it may not be the intent, but the wording definitely does that. And I think it's dreadful the way we've talked about the occupations people have chosen. So all of a sudden, literally, you know, if you're in the tourism industry, you're buggered. Let's face it, right?
Yeah, and
it was never a big payer anyway. This is back to the whole, you know, we're in Queensland and look at the makeup of Queensland industry. Tourism was an exceptionally small industry. There's a lot of people who weren't paid very much, to be quite honest, which I think is a shame. That's, you know, that's it. And I compare that against the resource sector, right? Where, you know, the person who loads a dishwasher is paid $90,000 a year at a mine site, right? You know, that's, so when you look at the economic impact of these industries, you've got to consider that. But now, you know, unless that, you know, you, the corner stores have been, you know, so there's been a lot of traditional retail that's been displaced by online. You might have said that always might have happened. Well, that's great. Obviously, if you're just saying, well, that always might have happened, you obviously didn't work in that space or own a business in that space, because it's a bloody callous thing to say. They say that because what we did, because a virus pandemic occurred, which will leave the vast majority of people who get it, the vast majority of people in the population untouched, not even sick.
Hmm.
We've had to destroy entire sectors of the economy, and literally, you know, and now all of a sudden the forces that are rising, the ones that are hosted in the US, domiciled in the UK, domiciled in Ireland, not paying any tax. So we've really hollowed out chunks of Australia. So I find that tough. So all that stuff's coming over into software. So I'm conflicted because we invest in that space and we're doing quite well. There's a lot of money in that space. Oh my God, there's a lot of money in that space. You're seeing how quick our deals are closing online. You know, I think we closed that one in 20 minutes today. We oversubbed it. We haven't closed it yet. So, you know, there's a lot of opportunity there. The one thing, if I was to analyze where the money's coming from, I would say that the more that central banks and governments pour, money in to help the economy, they're pouring subsidies, other bits and pieces and relief funding and welfare and whatever. It rises to the top almost instantly. It goes, just goes, bubbles to the top. So I think that in essence, it's a really bad way to help the economy.
That's right. It's not sustainable, surely. How much, stimulus and, you know, borrowing can happen from governments to, you know, if we go another year or so or two,
I mean, in Australia, it should have been easier things. They should have made for 12 months, they should have made superannuation contributions voluntary.
Yeah.
So you literally get 10% of your wage back. Okay, you're borrowing against your future, that's fine. But the other thing I was saying before, like, I've got a mate but he runs a more traditional construction style business, not in Queensland.
Yep.
And I spoke to him, and he's quite a down to earth chap. And I said, no, we'll survive. I said, but we'll have no savings left. So literally, they've just, you know, everything, he's my age, but 3-4 years older, I suppose. So he's mid 50s. And everything he's probably, you know, managed to get his business going. And probably the last 5 or 6 years, he's managed to actually build a nest egg. And to keep his business alive, that's just gone.
Well, I guess it's hard to know when the end is, right? And I think it's, we're seeing it. We're on the front lines of small businesses. We've got 4,000 that we look after, weekly, and we're seeing and hearing some of the, you know, people go, I wasn't expecting it to go this long. And, I guess then on the flip side of that, there's sort of announcements in Melbourne, around that. You know, obviously, if businesses won't open up unless you're vaccinated and things like that. So it's changing. I don't want to sort of go down those roads too much, unless you want to, but I think there's,
I don't want to be in a society where you demand to know someone's personal medical history before you do business with them. I think it's absolutely terrible. I'm not going to pass judgment on, we're a family that vaccinates, right? But I don't really care if you do or you don't. Especially with this one, because if you don't with this one, by the sound of it, just means you're going to get sick and not me.
Mm.
So I'm not saying you, but you know, someone other than yourself. So why do you care? Why do you care if someone's vaccinated or not? I actually think it's disgraceful. The fact that, you know, I'm looking forward to someone asking for my vaccine pass because I want to ask for theirs.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, no, show me yours first. If they get upset about it as well, why should you get upset about it? You shouldn't be demanding mine. Well, that's not a personal history. Did you get AIDS last night? Did you have anal sex with someone last night? You might have got AIDS from, for example. I mean, this is actually where it's going. Right? That's probably a horrible example. I shouldn't use that one, but.
Yeah, that's.
What are you now allowed to ask? You know, in all seriousness, I mean, we're going to be, and it's really weird too, because there are certain jobs where vaccinations have been required for many years. I had mates in the, I come from Rockhampton, right? And so if you didn't actually leave that town, sorry, Rocky people, but a large number of people up there, you know, they went and got jobs in the meatworks. They had to get vaccinated against, there's all sorts of diseases they got from cows. I think Q fever might have been one, I want to say. You have to be vaccinated to go and work in the meatworks, otherwise you're at risk of that. So I sort of get that. But that's almost like before you go when you know you've got to get that. It's not like all of a sudden, hey, this thing's come out, unless you get this, we're going to fire you. That's a much different story. I'm really keen to hear, I'm not a fan of trade unions. No, I shouldn't say that. I'm a fan of trade unions. I'm a fan of voluntary trade unionisms, and I'm a fan of competition in the trade union space. So I think there should be a selection of organisations and associations people can join to represent themselves, to represent them in the workplace. In Australia, you tend to have the ACTU sort of affiliated union dominating things. I think it would fix a lot in this country if you just had competition there. So I'm okay with people having collective bargaining power in the workplace. But where are the unions on this? You know, what is going on there? So,
yeah, it's definitely seems like there's just one lens everything's looking through, and I think it's it's creating a bit of divide too. I think, and probably in the next few months it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. Really.
Well, I think we got some good things. If you're against vax passports or whatever they call the damn things, we've got some history on our side, because we well and truly saw off the stupid COVID safe app, which is a diabolically piece of stupid technology put in the hands of people who've never been trustworthy with data. We've even seen that with it, and I'm actually surprised that the check-in apps have gotten the uptake they have, and they're quite simple to use, which is nice. But even in New South Wales, Western Australia and Queensland now, the cops have actually gone and got a warrant, got that data, and actually hunted down bad people. Now, we're in Queensland. This is a state where one of the premiers only 3 or 4 premiers ago used to use the police force as his own private political enforcement tool. This is JB Ockie Peterson, right? Maybe it was 5 or 6 premiers ago. Cops have been known to do this. You know what I mean? And literally, I don't want the state knowing where I go.
Yeah.
That's simple. And all the silly arguments have about, but you're on Facebook. I can voluntarily give those details to anyone I want. But now I'm compelled to hand them over to the state. And I have a problem that if the state goes to Facebook and demands my data, I have a problem with that as well.
Well, I think there was a law passed this week. It just gone.
Dreadful.
And there was an update on, you know, it was actually my daughter that brought it to me. She goes, hey, Dad, there's these, you know, terms and conditions I've just been updated on. And, you know, she's quite, you know, she reads a fair bit and everything. And yeah, and it was obviously that they can go in and without
hack your accounts, hack your phone.
Yeah, well, but just do it without letting you know and just go in there and do anything. And at a law enforcement level. And I think that's, it's interesting, you know, what's sort of with the way the world is now. And I think that's,
it's really weird. In Australia, we think we're this cool nation because, you know, we're all descended from convicts as well. But you've got to remember that. In amongst those convicts were the jailers as well. They're still amongst us at the same time. And that's what you're seeing in some of the disgraceful police behaviour and forcings and these lockdowns and cracking down on some of these protests. I've never seen US cops bash people at a protest like Australian cops have.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm actually more scared of an Australian policeman than a US policeman. At least I know there's restraint out there. Australian cops, you know, I think US cops are restrained because they're actually scared that the people in front of them actually have guns as well. Whereas in Australia, they know the person in front of them doesn't have a gun, so they can pull out the trunks and pepper spray and hook in. We're straying a fair bit off here, and you're probably, you know, interpreting a fair bit of my politics out of this, I imagine, but the reality, that's the reality. You've seen, like, going in and risking a pregnant mum in her pyjamas because she made a Facebook post.
It's crazy.
Just diabolical. Yeah. And the guy just a couple of days ago, he was out New South Wales, I want to say. He was out jogging. Was out exercising, I should say. We had a mask on outside. The cop has got him and said, I've got a medical exemption because I've got a cardiac condition. Didn't believe him. Hold him in the ground. He had a heart attack.
That's crazy.
Killed by the cops for not wearing a mask. I don't know if he died, actually. I shouldn't say that. But, you know, potentially, you know, attempted murder by cops for not wearing a mask.
It's absolutely ludicrous.
It's just, I can't.
Yeah.
Carried a rifle for this country for 9 years. I honestly can't believe we've descended to. It's just
horrible. Yeah, so it's I'm pretty pragmatic and try to be, you know, very passive in many ways when it comes to politics and what goes on and things like that. But it's a bit concerning when you start, you know, hearing stories like that. And a lot of them you don't hear about unless you know. So it's concerning. But I guess we'll see where it all goes. I want to talk to you about just a few sort of questions for the listeners about sort of getting to your mindset in terms of the question is, what advice would you give to your 16-year-old self to follow? Now, if you could whisper in the 16-year-old ear and go, hey, do this or don't do this.
I'm really happy where I am now personally, family sense and professionally. So I wouldn't, for as bad as that journey would have been, I don't believe in the question, because you literally, it could be so much better. No, it'll probably be that much worse. If you're really happy where you are now, we had a terrible, especially having a family, a terrible time. So, got there at the end, you might say, I wish it didn't happen. But if it didn't happen, we'd have the three beautiful kids I've got now, you know. So, you can't change a thing. I think if you like where you are now, if you don't like where you are now, I'm really, my only solace would be to say it could be a lot worse. And then you got to look back and think to yourself, well, did I make the right decisions? And you should always look back and try to understand your decisions and understand how you can make better decisions in the future. But no, I choose not to think about it.
That's a really great outlook. I love that. Do you have any habits or any?
However, if I was advising a friend's 16-year-old,
yes, right, yes, how's that? This is good. Yep,
I've done this a lot. I would say that, especially that a lot of them want to get to, I say, like, get into business. Right now, 16. Well, maybe if you got a good idea, if you got the skills. So for me, getting into business is, do you have the skills, the network, and the idea?
Yep.
So, yeah, you can get skills from a lot of places. I was self-taught. You can teach them yourself, for example. You can go to university or a school or a trade school or online learning, whatever it might be nowadays. If you go to university or trade school, you might pick up a network at the same time. So network's a group of people you start to set your future with. So they're people who can help you on your way. You might be co-founders with them in the business. They may be employees. They may be investors in your business at a later stage. Who knows? But you start that network. Know lots of people. Talk to lots of people. And you look around for an idea. You look around for, okay, what do you do? Maybe you don't know what to do at the start. Maybe you have this idea when you close your eyes, it just shimmers like stars. You can see what you want to do, right? That'd be great if everyone had that. It sometimes takes a few years to come across. Have those goals. There's nothing wrong with working for someone else for a couple of years. If you think you want to start a business in the online travel space, I would suggest that's a shit business during COVID. But in the XYZ space, and go and find XYZ person doing it now. Get a job with them, learn how to do it, get the skills, understand that because if they're in business, they're successful, they're probably not dumb. They're doing things a certain way. They may have ossified, they may have sort of, got a bit stale in their approach, but one stage they were the in thing. And you can learn a lot from that. So once again, then go there, continue to build your skills, build your network, get some capital behind you by saving money, and then start a business. But I'm a huge fan of people starting businesses.
I love that. And what advice do you reckon you'd say for them to ignore and say, hey, on the path, if you just ignore this stuff, you're going to be more likely to be successful? Is it that you need to go to uni to get this girl, or, you know?
Yeah, look, get this girl, did you say?
No, go to uni to get the skill.
Oh, skill, it's skill. Girl.
The girl. Yeah, okay. Either way.
So I think universities are very valuable places for conducting research. You know, my big problem with universities is that way we tend to believe that research is instantly transferable into the world of commerce. It typically isn't. Yep. Easily, if at all. It's a great place to go to get some skills. It's a great place to go to get a computer science degree or whatever you want to do, you know, whatever degree you think is relevant for your future, and then build your network. So, no, there's a lot of value to that. There is a lot of utility to that. I think universities are very poor value. And we have a good system in Australia with HECS, so you tend to delay most of the repayments of that for many years, which is good. I think that's a really good thing. So all things that I think, if there's more competition in the university space, it will tend to drive down prices and there'll be better value. So universities, the problem with universities is, and I have lots of problems with universities, this is one of my standard rants, is that the people who run them think they're clever because they run a big organisation. And, you know, everyone who's a CEO or a vice chancellor in this case, what the hell they call themselves, of a big organisation must be a genius. But, you know, university is this, they call them sandstone institutions. That just tells you how permanent they believe they are, right? Because their buildings are made of sandstone. How arrogant is that in this modern world, right?
Well, like Harvard, the guys over there, they're online fully now. It's
yeah.
Not, yeah.
And especially in Australia, where literally you have a supply, you have a deal flow, lead flow pipeline supply of young people coming through, and mum and dad are telling you, you must go to university to get your degree and do this, and the government's going to back with this, you know, we can pay it up front, or the government's going to back it and with a loan. There's no genius in them getting students. They're just going to turn up, right? There's absolutely no genius in them getting students. They think they're heroes.
Yeah.
And they stick their hand out for every government prize and award and grant, and it's just, they're anti-commerce would be my best description for them.
Yeah, is there any – I guess I'd be interested to sort of see if there's any industries that you can see that just won't be around or be changed dramatically, which is hard to say, and I know it's probably – I don't want you to sort of
– One of my favourite ones, so a few years ago I was a Queensland chief entrepreneur. It would have been definitely pre-COVID, about 3 years ago I suppose. I got around with, asked me what I wanted. It's a very generous position, Queensland government. I don't like the flavour of government, but I liked a lot of the people inside it, to be honest. And it was a very generous position to be offered, and I took that up. And I said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I want to, we're in Brisbane, and I co-founded, as you said before, this thing called River City Labs, a not-for-profit co-working space. We tried to encourage entrepreneurship and enterprise and other bits and pieces. And I said, well, we were doing, oh, golly, maybe 3 or 4 events a week. You know, you could have been morbidly obese and alcoholic on that pizza and beer, that place, you know, just, and it was good, all this great value content, but it was just in Brisbane. I said, right, I want to go once a month, I want to go outside the Southeast Queensland corner and do an event out there. And that's fine. I took my own plane. We loaded up full of people. I took my own plane. We put people in there from various walks of life and went out to, you know, from, golly, the furthest north we went was probably Leichhardt River, out to Cloncurry, down to St George, everywhere in between. Wandai, freaking Rockhampton, Gladstone, Emerald, Longreach.
It's unreal.
Everywhere. Mackay, every place in between. And it was just for Emerald. It was fantastic. So I want to go out and do that. So I believe in networking.
Yeah, yeah.
So I believe in, you know, literally taking it there. Let's find the local chamber of commerce. Let's put a business breakfast on or a lunch, whatever it might be. Get these people there to run a panel, question and answer. What's it take to, you know, let's just drag these conversations out because everyone in business wants to network. But if you're an Emerald, you've got the same 10 butchers, bakers, candlestick makers. Nothing wrong with butchers, bakers, and candlestick makers turning up every time, which is great that they network. But if you can just bring some fresh blood in.
That's right, yeah.
It takes one idea to kick off a larger business. It's amazing for a small community. Did that. I was huge in trying to fix telecommunications in Queensland especially. So the state government had access to thousands of route kilometres of fibre optic cable that were being used to essentially control power transformers and helped, I suppose, define a project to get those into corporate hands. I don't know if that's been successful or not. They ended up forming something called it was called Queensland Fibre Network, I think, in the end. Queensland Connectivity Network, QCN, Queensland Connectivity Network.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to free up some of that asset and as a wholesale thing just to promote, you know, bandwidth in the regions. And then the reason I got here was, and then it was flying cars. And I said, I want to promote, why do you want to promote flying cars? I'm like, so we live an hour from the city, right?
Yep. There's
a good reason. And for 22 kilometres in a straight line, which in a helicopter would take 11 minutes, it can take you an hour in the morning, for example. And so, not that I'm trying to encourage helicopters because they're quite noisy, but there was a massive now adoption and even 3-4 years ago acceleration of the technology behind flying cars, unmanned passenger carrying vehicles. I said, you know, if it's going to cost $4 billion to duplicate the M1 from Brisbane to Gold Coast, imagine if we just spent $4 billion on the software to run air traffic control properly, and these things could just race around, and you know, in a cubic kilometre of airspace, right, you can actually with 50 meter separation.
Is the technology there now?
In a cubic kilometre of airspace of 50 metres of separation, you can put 4,000 metres of car. There's not a single piece of rebar, concrete, traffic lights, roundabouts included in that at all. And you can just, you know, because it's software. You literally, the cars get a virtual lane in the sky for one of a better. And 50 metres separation. When's the last time you were 50 metres away from a car on a freeway?
You know what I mean? Yeah.
So, and you can, you know, and people sort of look at me and they can't understand. They say, okay, so there's this one flying car mob called Lilium, L-I-L-I-U-M, out of Europe.
Yep.
Right. It's like a squashed egg shaped thing. It's a pretty funky shape, actually. Electric.
It's the electric one, yeah.
Electric one, yeah. They're all electric. They don't like, you know, they're all sort of greenies and don't like really powerful things like fossil fuel. They're quieter too with electric, which is quite nice. So, but it can do like, actually it was quite good. It can take like five people, I want to say. They were talking, they were going to do something like about 150 knots, which is quite fast.
Wow, that's really fast.
But it was, ended up being like 17 minutes from Phrygian Beach to Brisbane City.
And is the range, that's pretty quick. Pretty good.
So just quickly, yeah. So you think about that, right? So you think about, 23 minutes from, yeah, it was under half an hour. I said to myself, if these things can do 300 Ks an hour, these things are 300 Ks an hour, and you're willing to sit in a commute for, let's say, half an hour, right? Put a pin in the middle of Brisbane City, get a bit of string, 150 kilometres on scale representation, and draw a circle.
Yep.
You can live anywhere there. So it's not where you have to live because you're going to commute. It's where do you want to live? Do you want to live at Perugian Beach, Moreton Island, Toowoomba in the summer because it's going to be a bit cooler, if you know what I mean? And, you know, and literally you could live for about, I don't know, 15, 16 bucks in electricity to fill this damn thing up with electricity, essentially, to go where you have to go one way.
That's incredible.
And it's like, and you want to build roads? To me, I'm like, as soon as you do that, and there's some noise issues and there's going to be some society issues. Do we want to see like heaps of flying cars out there? So we're going to be more spread out. We're not going to have to bunch up together inside of communities So for me, it was about flying cars. So to me, and I was actually just up, I did a helicopter flight this morning. I mentioned to you, Mike's place up at Daybra. And I just looked out there and you could see from Daybra, ocean view, you could see out to Moreton Island and back down to the city and stuff. And you're just like, it's like, it was 14 minutes of helicopter from Archerfield.
That's incredible.
That's just it. You know, it's 14 minutes. And helicopters are pretty unwieldy things that most people don't like because they're a bit noisy and it's a bit silly because they're pretty quiet. But
So the technology's there then. Is it the legislation to kind of make that stuff?
What happened in Australia? Our regulator here, CASA, is full of old people who believe that innovation is not for them. Literally, it is just – it's sad to watch when you consider that the march is going to be stolen on us from around the world. So – we'll import the technology from Dell. You know, if someone in the US or somewhere in China will do it, and we'll look at it. And in 5 years' time, we'll go, well, we think it's good for us now. In the meantime, we would have killed. You know, what, 500 people a year on the roads, whatever it might be. And the thing about road traffic accidents is interesting. They did the study in the Northern Territory when they reduced the open speed limits down to. They reduced them at 100, 110 or something. They really reduced them quite badly. And fatalities went up.
Wow.
And I'm like, what the hell? And it's your time in transit is a bigger factor than the speed, alcohol, and a few other bits and pieces. Alcohol to a point and a few other inhibiting factors because you get fatigued.
You get fatigued, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. If you can be on the road for 6 hours as opposed to eight, you have literally, quarter of the chance. What, you're one quarter less likely to have an accident. So which is massive when it comes to this sort of statistics, right? So if you're only going to spend 23 minutes in a really dangerous, in the dangerous transit phase, Brisbane to Perugian Beach, as opposed to 2 hours 40 in that goddamn freeway, excuse me.
It's hectic, yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
And it surely, I mean, at the moment, there's not a lot of people coming into Australia, right? Zero.
No.
But we're moving around a fair bit. But when it opens up again, you know, the infrastructure obviously where we live, there's only one road in one. So, but they're talking about developing stuff over here. So surely that's just going to mean more traffic, more congestion, more. So, yeah, I mean, clearly there's got to be other solutions.
We need a tunnel built from Brisbane City. Just pop it out. Just over
there. So the Hyperloop. Is that something that would be a solution?
It's fixed point to point linear infrastructure. I don't get it. I understand the technology. Elon Musk doesn't likes Hyperloop, understandably, because he's got some, you know, he's got a dog in that fight. Doesn't like unmanned aerial vehicles because of the noise issue. I agree. I think noise will be a factor in this deployment. But I saw a video released by SpaceX where literally they were going to be launching rockets from New Jersey. So people from New York could get the other side of the planet in 10 minutes.
A fair bit louder.
I don't know. It's like a bomb. It's like an atomic bomb going off across right? So I'm like, you don't look what people say, you look what they do. And I'm sorry, but you're just bipolar. It probably is bipolar, to be honest, but but that set of opinions is quite bipolar. So there's some water going under that bridge yet. Do we want a little bit of road noise? Do we want a little bit of noise in the air, for example? to not have the 1 hour commute.
But surely passenger stuff would make sense instead of just personal flying cars.
Well, like I think it's flying cars. Yeah, look, I think, you know, I think that the 1 to 2 person transport vehicle is definitely in the next 5 years. I think the power requirement to lift anymore, that it really is, there's a power issue there.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And the heavier that thing is, the faster, the more air you've got to push, and that's where the noise comes from. So I actually think that they'll be smaller for longer.
Okay.
Unless there's a radical sort of anti-gravity thing comes out, or yeah, maybe Musk has got one of those in his back pocket. Who knows? Could be the case.
It could happen. It wouldn't surprise me. Yeah, with the transport sort of issues in general, is it, do you think maybe the autonomous cars could be a thing, like the Uber kind of looking at?
Yeah, look, I think that there's a lot of efficiencies in there, and I've had this question a lot when I was pushing the barrow as chief entrepreneur for flying cars. So what about, and then the government was like, no, we're going to work on these, you know, these amazing sort of autonomous, these rules. And we tend to bring rules in before we actually bring in innovation, which is, which is ridiculous, right? They don't get what innovation means. Innovation means no rules, so you can do what you want.
And I just want to sort of segue straight into that, because obviously rules, people, and I've seen it in the music industry where people are creatively writing music for, say, Triple J, because and it's shaping the art form in a way.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
And I guess in a similar context, this is happening with innovation.
Yeah, yeah. But on the autonomous cars, and I've talked about regulation and innovation impeding regulations all day. But the reality is that car is still going to be on the same road. It's the same width freeway.
Hmm.
Miss Daisy's still going to be allowed to drive on that. Right? The jalopies will still be out there. You'll have the random issues of people. It will make it more efficient as you get close to the city. There's just width. You can't fit any more in there, to be honest. So you get some efficiency improvements. But, you know, if they're double digits percents, I'll be, you know, I'd say low, you know, 10 to 20% efficiency.
Yeah.
Which might be, you know, like adding extra half lane type similar impact, if you know what I mean. So you'll get that many more vehicles in there. But when you park them, okay, so with Uber, you can recycle the cars and get around, but people do like car ownership.
I think you're right, yeah. So I can't imagine having other people just all day going through in my, you know, car. It's essentially just Uber.
Well, if we haven't got autonomous transport working around cities yet with respect to city loop buses, where it's the most fixed environment, this bus only ever goes that way, that way, that way, that way. You know exactly where it's going to go. You can get out there and you can spray a yellow line on the road for it to follow, right? That'd be the easiest. Like, how's it going to know where to go? It's got to follow the line on the road. We actually just, you know, embed a wire, whatever you want to do, right?
Yep.
If we can't make it work there, maybe there's a lack of will to make it work there, and there's transport unions as well for the bus drivers. But if we can't make it work there, I struggle has got a more open freeway with more variables to consider.
Mm.
And same thing, people talked a lot about the drone space with respect to delivery as well. And, you know, and they're doing it in Canberra, I want to say they're delivering some stuff, but you wait for the first coronial inquest after someone's killed by a pizza carrying drone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially in this country, right? Mm. They'll go bananas, right? So, there's still some stuff down the bridge yet, but regulation innovation. So, and in this space, and I was talking about this, and I got to talking to there's an association of unmanned aerial vehicle association. I can't remember their name now.
Mm-hmm.
Joe was one of the guys. Joe Altry was one of the guys involved in it. And he said, "Oh, we want you involved, and it's great you're advocating. But we want you involved in this space because you know we want to be proactive with the regulation of this sector." And I said, "The vehicles and the uses aren't even here yet." And he goes, "Oh, yeah, but we're going to bring the regulation in place ready for it." But we don't know what's happening. So, yeah, but we're going to engage government, and government wants to know what regulation they can put in place. And we'll try with none.
Mm.
And then because that way then everyone's going to – the more you regulate, it regulates about square pegs, square holes. And these guys are even – it's even worse because they're trying to regulate for an industry that doesn't exist yet, for inventions that don't exist yet. They're saying, we're pretty sure that they're going to actually design square pegs. So, therefore, all you can have is a square peg, and we're going to design the regulation, which is a square hole. It's worse.
Crazy.
And as soon as you do that, you just rob innovation. So, the less we regulate, not in an economic sense, but also in an innovation sense, the better off we'll be.
Yeah. And I strongly believe in that. I think at the moment, you only play within the playing field you've got to play in, and you only innovate within that usually. So, yeah, that's I think definitely deregulating stuff would make a lot of sense, and just fuel innovation. And how can we compete globally if we've got, you know, a different set of rules or different, we're more sort of, you know, to your point earlier with, say, Silicon Valley and the different, you know.
Done quite well. I mean, COVID's been interesting. The perception in Australia until the last few weeks has been that we've handled it quite well. And now we've just gone batshit crazy by locking down cities for, like, you know, one or two infections, right? I mean, we're in Queensland, I think we're open up, but we all know that the crazy Anna, she gets two infections and we're done, right? And we're at school holidays 2 weeks away. So everyone's just like holding a week and a half away.
Yeah.
Holding our breath just to get through, right? Because I think every other school holidays we've been locked down to some degree at this point.
Yeah.
She's not going to get, she won't let us get away with it again. So, and she's got dangerous Dr. Jeanette Young, who literally wants to see no one die from anything they don't have to. So, like, she's taking her control freak mentality, and she's got the ear of the premier. She's the most dangerous. Our chief health officer at the moment is the most dangerous woman in Queensland, in Australia. She's the worst sort of tyrannical overlord, because she's doing it because she believes it's for your own good. Mm. She's not. I prefer someone motivated by malice and have someone motivated by the fact they want to do it for my own good, because then nothing will stop them from protecting me. Someone's doing it maliciously, that they actually have some bounds. The person who's doing it for your good has no bounds. That's actually a really dangerous person.
Well, what bothers me is the lack of a rounded conversation around it. Like, for example, the treatments, you know, and this professor's and, you know, watched a video which was pretty clear that this person had, you know, they've been globally trying to work on the best treatments and they've been everything else. But
none of that. Careful treatment words. You're going to put this up on YouTube. You probably be careful what you say here, right?
You've got to be careful. Yeah, I'm certainly not.
Isn't it great? All of a sudden, the cool kids are now the censors.
Yeah.
Can't we mention, you know, certain words? I mean, if you're out there thinking, you know, that isn't it cool that we get to shut people up, you know, the censors were never the cool kids. The censors were the fucking bullies and the shitheads, right?
Yeah.
And right now, they're shutting down conversations that people don't want to hear.
Yeah.
And if you're one of those, you're one of the shitheads and the bullies, to be quite honest.
Mm.
But what gets me is the easier ones to say, we've known this thing, we've probably known a lot about this since April last year. You know, we've got serious February, March. We started to know more April, May. One thing we do know is it kills old people. The impact falls disproportionately in the elderly population, right? With comorbidities. What's the biggest comorbidity? Obesity. Yeah. Where's the Life Unit program been for the last 12 months? Why haven't been drowning the airways by saying, get out, get fit, drop 10 kilos, and you'll probably halve your chance of dying from COVID. Get in the sun, get outside. Vitamin B has been, it's been known to be, for most respiratory conditions, has been known to be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole bunch of good common sense things we could have done in the meantime, but now we went, I hope the vaccines get here.
Yeah.
And stay inside until they do. That was our strategy. And there's some home treatment things that you can do as well, which, you know, drug names you can't talk about, right? I don't want to stretch in the vaccine stuff because it's just going to annoy people.
Oh, no, it's all right. It's an interesting world we're living in. I just want to talk to you about some profound ideas that you might have read about, or a book you've read recently, or heard about, or it might be, I know everyone's talking about Simon Sinek, or is there anything that you've sort of come across recently you went, oh, that's actually a really good idea?
I'm actually pretty boring when it comes to books. I read a lot during the day, like, you know, pitch decks and, you know, articles from this and that and all. So I do a lot of technical reading. So if I listen to something in my own time, so to speak, my favourite genres, and I don't read anymore, you listen to audiobooks, right? So I go on a walk for an hour in the morning, come past here every morning. You never hear working at 5 a.m., you lazy bugger.
I know,
probably at home. If I'm listening in that environment there, it's my favourite genres are, you know, sort of large space opera warfare type stuff, Star Wars type things, but better than Star Wars. Star Wars is pretty shit, non-fiction. But pretty shit fiction, excuse me, or zombie, post-apocalypse. I've been in the post-apocalypse and zombie stuff. I love it. I've listened to it all day, and I've probably listened to a few hundred titles on Audible, and all just post-apocalypse.
Have you got a favourite? Like, is there one that you'd recommend?
Oh, there's a series of them. For books, and I actually read this as a book, so Peter Hamilton as an author I really enjoy.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's dystopian, Night's Dawn trilogy, sorry,
yep.
Which has really got me into science fiction pretty hard, and that large, expansive universe, big space opera battles, Miltech out the wazoo. So I like Miltech and that sort of stuff. But so I don't so much get into I suppose thinking in my own time is more, you know, escapism, to be honest. Stuff we do at work is, you know, interesting. We back a lot of, you know, we like the things that we like, the things that are going ahead, things that put power back in people's hands. So the deal we launched today was Perla. That was it's a platform that sort of the anti-Robin Hood platform that allows people to actually take a bit more control of their financial future, a bit more of a democratization sense. We like developer tools that we like, tools that benefit entrepreneurs. We've got a great business in Sydney called Bookapy. So that's going well. Tim's an amazing entrepreneur. We're going to bring an executive onto his team as well from one of my previous startups.
What's Bookapy do?
They have three apps. So they're a financial, they're a fintech. So they have three apps. They have, sure, you know this one better. Sure, they have Easy. Oh God, they have an expense app, payrolling app, an invoicing app.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just get rid of that. It's all right. And an invoicing app. So all very light touch, all very easy to use, doing lots of throughput, and with a large amount of capacity to innovate and do bring various bits and various other markets in and various other monetization methods in, I suppose. Been hundreds of thousands, but we're using about 10 bill a year going through his three apps. So
it's huge.
Yeah, he's done really well with amazing sort of you know, he's only got had 37,000 reviews on Play Store and 4.7 average. Wow. Oh no, it was just you can't fake that much, right? So really, really good. And Tim's an amazing entrepreneur. You know, he was doing computer science down in Sydney, had to pay his way, he was a tiler trying to pay his way. And just literally had trouble issuing invoices and expenses and stuff. So he wrote this app himself, and it got to be more profitable than tiling, right? So
that stuff.
That was how the business started. So, you know, tools that benefit entrepreneurs. We've got a super app. We've got a fintech super app in Africa called Chipper Cash. That's gone really well. We've got two businesses in Africa, maybe about to be a third. Payday advance business in Indonesia. So we'd have, you know, we'll invest in lots of people and lots of jurisdictions and lots of places, and not just Australia and the usual suspects, you might think.
And there's the Pushers as well, right? That's another one.
That's an interesting one, isn't it? Yeah. So it's Justin and Sandy, the entrepreneurs there, they're just fantastic. So they're doing so well. They have a marketplace and retail business that sells sneakers.
I was on there the other day looking for a set of Jordans, and it's a pretty good site.
It is, and
they've done a good job.
It is, yeah. And I think we have to probably change our reporting tempo, but he's doing really well. So
it's great.
And it was one of the ones that my team. I've got a good team, and I had to back that team too, right? Because I'm like, you want me? And my wife is, so our investment committee is. Members of our team, and it's our family's money, so it's myself and my wife, essentially. You meet my wife, Emily.
Yeah. Sure.
And she's gone like, oh, this one's great. I'm like, sneakers? It's like, and it ticked a lot of boxes aside from like, I don't want to invest in sneakers. But we did. And it's, you know, and the entrepreneurs there, they are just fantastic.
Oh, and our kids, they're right in tune with that. And they're on there having a look through it. And I think StockX is the big sort of, market, and that's just gone through the roof. So it's exciting stuff. Just want to quickly ask you, if you had a global ad campaign that you could run and to reach billions of people right now with an unlimited budget, but you could literally just get a message out there right now, a word, a sentence, is there anything that would benefit the world in a way?
Benefit the world.
That's a tough question.
Yeah, the world isn't this homogenous chunk, right? The world's a pretty different sort of thing.
It could be in the context of entrepreneurship or entrepreneurs.
Look, I think that my message with entrepreneurship was, don't die wondering. I suppose get out there and try. But I'm at heart, I'm a free enterprise, centre right, financially conservative libertarian. Right, so I'm not so much socially conservative, but definitely financially conservative. So, so for me, it would always be about freedom. And what message is that? We're seeing the terrible situation for 39 poor million people in Afghanistan who've been just abandoned by just a psychotic decision from the US president. Excuse me. feel for everyone there. Not just, you know, there's obviously there's an entire population there that's had, you know, 20 years of somewhat progress. All of a sudden, it's just been put back in charge of like this medieval bunch of just dickheads. So, you know, I don't understand people who want to oppress. Why do you want to impose your will on somebody else? It's sort of, you know, give them all the options and the choices and just, you know, whatever. You know, yeah. Get on with it, right? So it takes a difference. So, you know, just, Jesus, I don't know, be nice to each other.
Yeah.
Respect each other, you know.
So. That's a good message, especially in the context of everything going on in the world right now. It's just be respectful.
Yeah, be respectful. Yeah, yeah. Stop. There's an authoritarian strain coming through. And we have got that in us. Oh my God, we're essentially tribal people, right? So we don't usually like the others, whatever the others happen to be, you know. That's how we've evolved. So, and it's, you can see it coming through. There's nastiness out there. And there's, you know, there's efforts to divide us back up into groups again, which is just counterproductive.
I think obviously the way social medias work, where you get fed with the AI more of the stuff you're interested in, which can be dangerous, right? Because you end up in your own filter bubble.
Well, I get that. I don't watch TV. I watch YouTube now, basically. So, it keeps feeding me old episodes of Shark Tank, which I get sick of. you do see a bit of that. I try and read outside. I shouldn't say when I get in the morning, I do read the newspapers on an iPad, but I read the newspapers. Which is, you know, in Brisbane Heights, the Courier Mail, just to see when Anna's going to lock us down next. No, but in the Australian as well, you know, and I think the Australian's got an exceptionally balanced view. You know, any newspaper might be panned as being right wing or conservative, but Jesus Christ, they've got Stephen Conroy, Graham Richardson, they've got Peter Van Onselen in there, they've got some of the most lefty guys who I force myself to read, and sometimes I walk out bleeding eyeballs.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've got to try and get that rounded opinion on things. You know, but Stephen Conroy was one of the few Labour politicians that I actually respected. I respect him for one reason. I didn't like any of his policies. I respect the way he handled himself, because most politicians will actually tell you what you want to hear to have a pleasant social interaction and then go off and do something totally different. Stephen Conroy wouldn't. He'd get in your face and he'd tell you exactly what he didn't like you and what he was going to do. Right? There was no lies coming out of his mouth, right? And I didn't like what he did, but, you know, I've subsequently respected that he had a strong enough will to stand up and just something else I'm going to do. You don't like it, you can go and vote for something else, I suppose. I don't know. So
I think that has really come through, particularly just talking to you today about how, whether it's in business or whatever it is, the same things for how it is and you know, no bullshit.
Well, you can't always as well. I mean, you do have to, you know, I do pull back a bit, which makes you wonder what else I don't say, but because, you know, you don't always make friends by telling what you think. You know, there's politeness involved and there's some, you know, you might have parts of your personality you don't really need to expose other people because you understand more about yourself. But for, you know, for the most part, it's especially like when I deal with entrepreneurs, and they're exceptional. I love them. Don't get me wrong, but they're exceptionally blinkered people, right? They all sit there, and I've seen them, especially some of the entrepreneurs through Shark Tank who've just spent extraordinary amounts of money slowly going broke. And you're like, oh God, you've got to, you know, if you do anything else, it's better. You know what I mean? And keep going this business. And I call it the figurative slap in the face. Figurative, literal means when you do it. Figurative means, you know, it's a euphemism for a slap in the face, right?
Yep, yep.
You got to give them that figurative slap in the face and make them wake up themselves to realize just how bad what they're doing is, if you know what I mean. And, you know, the thing about advice is you're free to ignore it. You know, sticks and stones. It used to be sticks and stones will break my bones, but words never hurt me. Now it seems like if you do bad words and, you know, you can get put in jail, but literally you've got to say, well, I think your business is shit and you're going broke and you should stop it. Or, you know, that guy who got advice on you, he sounds like a criminal because he probably is a fucking criminal. Right? Yeah. And it might not be. I might be wrong. You know, the thing about being, you're always wrong 50% of the time. It's either yes or no, right? When you think about it. So, but here's my advice, and this is why I'd do it. And people say that comes across as mean. I don't think I really have delivered anything in a mean way. I've delivered some advice that comes across as exceptionally, I think, direct.
I'll use the music industry as an example. I see a lot of people that probably don't have the network of people around them, or the people that they do have around them are just sort of yes people or whatever, and they'll go along a certain path. And by the time they actually get out to releasing something or whatever, it's probably not that great.
Yep.
So do you think the network piece is important there? Make sure you get the right people that are honest around you, not your...
Oh, yeah. Mum and dad. Actually, if I say one thing about the start pick, I think it's bad for that, is like people are super encouraging, which is great. You know, there's probably too many safe spaces in the entrepreneurship space, which is not bad when you're starting out. You don't really know what's going to work. So you probably want default people encouraging as opposed to a bit more honest candor. I tend to bring the honest candor to conversations more than encouragement. I mean, really super early stuff. We know it's going to work. It's like, wow, that sounds really cool. No, might work. I'll usually back those yeses with dollars at the same time, right?
So, but that's the benefit, right? If you get that advice early on and you get that feedback early on, you can pivot, you can change. Yeah. And I saw a thing that said that in businesses that were more likely to succeed, this is a Harvard study, I think, were ones that pivoted and changed quite quickly and early on, as opposed to them sticking to the business plan that they,
No business plan survives contact with customer, right? You've got to change that. So we used to say in the army, no battle plan survives contact with enemy. And same in business. You know, you've just got to be prepared. I heard a good one not long ago. People should say, I don't mind a business plan providing it's written in pencil, so it's easy to rub out.
Love it.
So, I do think you need something to judge your progress against. You can just say, I'm not going to have a business plan. Well, no, you've got to start with a plan. So you have to measure your progress against something. And if your plan's wrong, then you change it and you measure against a new plan. So you've got to be quick to iterate in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I agree. Yeah. But I've also seen people potentially pivot away from a business too fast and otherwise profitable business. So you can pivot away from something that otherwise, if you're just given a bit more, it's like, well, you haven't really tried everything yet.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, in balance, I totally agree.
And is there any bad advice that you hear in the industry?
I hear lots of shit advice.
Yeah.
I get so frustrated. I shouldn't say that. So all advice is relevant if you know the person's background.
Yeah.
Right. So I always, when I go and do talks in public and stuff, I always say, like, here's my background. Hopefully the presenters have actually presented my background in the praise. I have to spend like 6 minutes going through my background, right? But if they haven't done that, I'll sit there and say, okay, this is what I've done. I come from, regional Queensland, military, telecoms, Shark Tank, chief entrepreneur, et cetera, startup investor. Right, so you know my background. So if I start giving you advice on how to build a plastics factory, you should fucking ignore me, shouldn't you, right? So literally you have people who come out who are regurgitating TechCrunch articles, who've never had a business, let alone success in business, issuing advice to people. So if you find that person's background out, you can still have a pleasant social exchange. You go, right, this guy's done nothing, or this person's done nothing, and he's given me all this advice because he's probably regurgitated. That's probably good advice, right, because he's regurgitated from someone who was better than him, right? But how much weight are you going to put in it? You know what I mean? So, okay, so he's repeating something that he's never done.
I see it a lot on social media and stuff. A lot of people offering courses and things, and they've never done it themselves, you know?
Oh, and I've... My word, yes. Oh, my God, yes. And one thing I rail against is, like, literally you see these self-help experts and how to run businesses and stuff, and literally they've never run a business other than this thing to fleece people for money to get on their online course how to run a business. And I'm like, but typically, and I've worked with them because the ones I've worked with, they're quite upfront about that. They explain their background. So to me, it's like, well, okay, you're going to get help from this person. Look at their background, what they've done. And if you think their background can provide some utility to you, then fine, pay for that advice. So,
And,
you know, adults are free to burn their fingers.
Is there any quotes? There's one, a few in over the years that sort of drawed on, I guess, and make your profession your obsession. You never work a day in your life. Work harder on yourself than you do on your business. There's certain things that I find quite,
mine's a bit more practical.
Yeah.
Never spend a buck to save 50 cents.
I like that. That's great.
So our first accountant, our first business, Kevin Burrow, CPA, we chose him for a rigorous selection process. He was the closest accountant to where we lived at the time. And ended up being an amazing sort of professional who assisted us in our first business. And so he gave three bits of advice. One was, it was in relation to tax time savings. You know, it's tax time's coming up. You should, go and buy the new expensive printer because you can claim it on tax. And he goes, well, it's saving a buck to claim 50 cents. That's ridiculous. Don't do it, which is pretty cool. I can't remember the exact piece of advice now, but essentially it's the biggest problem we saw in business is when owners took cash out of the till to pay themselves or to go and buy a pie or something. So I said, only give you – pay yourself a wage and only take dividends after that. So you know exactly what the business is doing, right? So never treat your business like a cash register. That was the advice, right? So put it all through the books, run it all properly. At the end of the day, take dividends, the actual true value of your business, right? And Gerber does a lot. If you ever – Michael Gerber with the E-Myth, he speaks a lot towards that sort of mentality actually in some of his stuff too. And his third piece of advice was, this business is too big for me. Get a better accountant. So he fired himself, right? So, which is awesome, right? So, lovely man, yeah. So, definitely knew what we needed. I think he could have taken us on and done more with us, but he would have had to spend less time with his other customers. So he said, yeah, you should go find someone else. We kept him as a personal accountant, but just not as a business accountant. So, yeah.
Love that. Just wrapping up with a couple of more questions. Obviously, we've just been talking about a bunch of great stuff today. The question is, what's one of the most worthwhile investments you've made? And it can not be physical. It can be personal. It can be anything like that. But, what's one of the best, most worthwhile investments you've made in terms of money, time, or energy?
And that's a really good question, eh? Money, time, energy. So I hope you can cut a lot of the stammering out here because I'm trying to think about that. So, I mean, we've had some great fiscal investments, I suppose. My second startup, Pipe Network, is probably the best on return.
Yeah.
Scale.
That was huge.
That would have been close to probably about a 500 times return, I want to say.
That's incredible.
Yeah. But so far as a bit more sort of ethereal type thing, best investment. I don't want to answer that.
Well, why don't I ask it a different way? So best, most worthwhile investment you've made in terms of, through as a tech investor just recently. Yeah. Is there something that you found over the last 5 to 10 years? Like Go One's gone through, that's incredible.
Go One's been good. Best one. It's like trying to pick your favourite kid, mate. So,
you've got to be a bit careful
there. Look, I think what we've built at 1013 is actually pretty special, to be honest. So 1013 is a highly aligned syndicate investment platform, that basically where investors come on board and become our customers. And then my family continues investing what we always have, but we make a portion of investment available to the wider syndicate. And that we're finding some great deals through that. We're getting a lot of great traction. We've got 300 investors. We've got 320 pretty soon. We're about to return our first funds to investors tomorrow. Or when this airs 6 days ago. 1013, and we're managing to redefine the way that investors get involved, because there's been a massive problem with angel investors getting access to deals. So, cause it's very hard to find the right deal, because shit deals are easy to find and good deals are hard to find. And then it's, if you have a sensible portfolio approach, you probably should be putting 1/50th of what you want to invest in any one investment. So you're going to do 50 investments over 10 years. Or over 5 years, 10 a year for 5 years. You're only putting 2% of what you actually want to put in that space into an investment, essentially. Mm. So they're small checks by definition, they're small checks. So if you do find that investment, you can get in. The person who's running the business, who's seeking the investment, doesn't want to deal with a bunch of small checks. Yeah. So there's access and all sorts of issues. So we're really helping to give people, we're democratizing the venture capital, which I think is actually pretty cool. So yeah,
it's very cool. And I couldn't believe the amount of due diligence that goes into some of these.
When we looked at the earlier question, we looked about working from home and stuff, and I was very much a traditional boss. One thing I always wanted to do was to get some sort of time allocation, time sheeting system in place to understand how much time we spent on DD, and then post that actually running the portfolio at the same time, so we get the splits right. So we brought that forward because I thought, they're going to work from home. I have to understand when and how long people are working for, and participation in that has been at times not quite voluntary. It's been hard. Young people don't like doing time. We had a really easy to use program called Clockify. Another tech startup. It's like
sounds pretty good.
Cool. It's like about $6 a month to use it or something. It's nothing, right? And it's really quite good. And that's how we can. And I reckon our crew only track 3/4 of their time. So what you're seeing is probably only 3/4 of the damage bill. But then that one deal we did, that was probably can't name the name, but we had to do a little bit of reorganization. It was like 380 hours to get through and get that business ready for investment. So, yeah.
That's insane. Yeah. That's a lot. And,
I've just done about 40 hours of myself trying to actually convince a US clearinghouse that we weren't some sort of, because we've done this exit, we weren't some sort of dangerous, weird VC fund in Australia that was going to fail AML, any money laundering, know your customer. So literally I've every morning on to Denver and phone calls, this exit process has just been surreal. So nothing's easy in our space. There's no such thing as a cookie cutter deal. They just don't exist.
And I absolutely love that. With how do people find more information about
1013.vc, so TEN13.vc. New website launched yesterday or today or something. I'm launched recently anyway, the new website. We worked on it for about too long. So looks pretty funky. Lots of information there. We do lots of seminars and virtual boardroom lunches and other bits and pieces.
So that's amazing. And where do people find you online, Steve?
I hate my online presence. I've sort of got away from Twitter because I was going to get in trouble on Twitter. So our marketing people have taken out my Twitter account. That way I don't post trolls to stupid lefties. Excuse me. So I'm on Twitter, but I don't know what goes on there because my life got better when I stopped looking at Twitter. So we've got LinkedIn and also Facebook, Steve Baxter. I imagine our new website, 1013VC, it's got the links there. So go there and find the links out. I should know that. I used to have a lot of stuff on Twitter, but I kept rolling hand grenades into battles just to understand. It's a lot of fun. There's certain things you can say that would just set people off.
And especially in today's world, I think it's probably not a good idea.
No, well, at the same time, I did a while back there, I wanted to understand why I held some of the positions I held and some of the issues, social issues. And so I'd take exceptionally egregious statements, mate, and just to understand, everyone come back at me. I got 99% was just pure flame and horrible. Some people come back with some really structured arguments and made me really try and look into and understand why I thought what I thought. And I probably modified some of my – I think I changed, but definitely modified some of my positions, probably softened a few, probably hardened a couple of other ones in certain areas based on just having that open conversation. If you can just ignore the trolls and the shitheads and the death threats and everything else, because it's horrible. It's actually a net negative for democracy in the world, Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully that's part of what's getting better in terms of where the internet's heading and things like that. Steve, I can't thank you enough for today. Your wisdom around investing, entrepreneurship, everything that you're doing, I think for the startup community and the investment community through 1013 and other things. Go check Steve out, 1013.vc.
All right, cheers, mate.
Cheers. Legend.